This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Saturday, Governor Scott Walker and Republican legislative leaders announced they're removing a controversial open records overhaul from the state budget. We'll talk to a state capitol reporter about that news. First, does it pay to be nice to people? We often hear that term, nice guys finish last, which people use to explain some negative work and relationship behaviors. A few weeks ago, a Georgetown business professor wrote an op-ed for the New York Times lamenting the decline of civility at work. Nearly 20 years ago, only a quarter of the people she surveyed said they'd been treated rudely at work. But by a few years ago, the number of people reporting rude behavior at work had jumped to over half. Research from the Human Cooperation Laboratory at Yale University looked at the costs and benefits of being nice, and it reached the conclusion that being nice really does pay off. We want to hear from you about this. Do you agree that it pays to be nice, or do you think it's a waste of time? Do you go out of your way to be nice to friends, family members, coworkers? Why do you do it? Just because it's a good thing to do, or because you get something out of it too? Do you think people treat you differently when you're nice? Call and share your experiences at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. David Rand joins us now. He's a professor of psychology, economics, and management at Yale University, and he's the director of Yale's Human Cooperation Lab. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So a short version, it sounds like being nice is good for an individual, good for a business as a whole. How does a cooperation lab measure that kind of thing, though?
So there's two different ways we think about these questions. One is using sort of math and computer simulations and game theory kind of things. But then the other big part is we run lots of experiments. Some of them are lab experiments where we have people come into the lab and we give them money, and then they have the choice to either keep the money for themselves or pay the money to help other people. And we, you know, look at what strategies people use and what winds up working well for them. And then we also do field experiments with real organizations out in the world, to see how these things from the lab translate into the real world.
So how does being nice play out, say, in an office or a workplace environment? What, apart, again, from the intrinsic niceness of being nice, what do I get out of it?
So the key thing to remember is that when you have an interaction with someone, that's typically, particularly in the work context, that's not the only time you're going to interact with that person. And so your actions today have consequences in the future. So you might think, well, I could take advantage of this person right now and that would, you know, get me some short-term gain. But when you do that, you forget that there's going to be a long-term cost, because the next time that you're in a position where you need something from that person or they have the chance to take advantage of you, if you do today, that will lead them to take advantage of you tomorrow, whereas if you're helpful towards them, that can make them be inclined to help you in the future.
Now, your research takes it a step further, David. It's not just reciprocity. I'm nice to you now, you're nice to me next time. You say it pays off to be nice to someone even after they've stepped on you in one way or another two or even three times.
Right. So the idea is that this reciprocity is a key concept, but the issue is that in real life, a lot of the time there's a chance for mistakes where I mean to do the thing that is helpful to you, but through some force beyond my control, either I can't come through with what I was supposed to do, or I'm confused about what's actually going to be helpful for you, and so I wind up doing something that's actually not helpful to you. And so if you're playing a strategy that says, the minute someone screws me over once, I cut them off forever, that can be really costly for you, because you can have these really valuable relationships that wind up getting destroyed because somebody makes a mistake, and then the minute they make a mistake, you cut them off. That can really be costly.
Now, and a counter argument I imagine a lot of people are thinking now is, aren't there a lot of rich and famous successful people who are jerks? I mean, Steve Jobs of Apple is known, I think, even among people who like him, as a difficult person to work with. He did well. His company, obviously, Apple, did very well. We can all probably think of famous movie stars, music stars who have done quite well while stepping on the people underneath them. So what about them?
Yeah, so, you know, these are sort of general principles rather than absolute rules that hold in all cases. But it's typically the case that when you have these kind of repeated interactions, that it's always the case that there are going to be future consequences. It could be if you are, like, really amazingly brilliant, then you can get away with being a jerk because people will want to work with you anyways. But like for the rest of us, you know, a big part of who you want to work with, who you want to sort of help, be willing to help, is have they helped you before in the past? And another thing that's really important is that the fact that future consequences exist can make cooperating pay off. So if the other people in your office are all using a strategy that says, I will be helpful to you so long as you're helpful to me, then that makes the office as a whole better off, it makes everyone individually better off, and it makes it so it's in your self-interest to be cooperative today so that you reap the benefits of reciprocal cooperation in the future. But it's also true that if you're in an office where the social norm is, no matter what you do, I'm going to try and take advantage of you, then even though the interaction is repeated, there's no incentive to be cooperative because the other people are going to exploit you. But it's possible that you are in an environment where if everybody else is being non-cooperative, then it doesn't make sense for you to be cooperative. But if you're in an environment where other people are willing to cooperate as long as you do, then it becomes better for everyone to cooperate. And so if you are like a manager of a business or an organization, a big part of the challenge is to try and establish a norm and a culture whereby people cooperate and you know, you get this kind of reciprocal cooperation going.
Talking to David Rand with Yale's Human Cooperation Lab about the benefits of being nice. He says in many cases, based on his research, we really do get ahead by getting along. We're kind to others. They're kind to us. It helps all of us and maybe the organization we're part of as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And we've got Kat on the line in Green Bay. Kat, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Actually, I have three folds on the issue that you're discussing because I've been on both sides. When I used to bartend, being nice actually gave me more tips. So everybody else wanted to work with me because people were willing to wait an extra 15 minutes and still tip me quite well because I was nice and pleasant. Now, on the other side of the coin, if somebody is nice and pleasant, say I'm taking my car into a shop, and they actually treat me like a person, and they're nice and pleasant, they may be $100 more expensive for changing my muffler or whatever, but I'll keep going back to them. They will automatically have my business. Now, in return, what I've also noticed, and things that we don't seem to keep in the city I'm in right now, I don't seem to notice a lot of people doing the same, is that somebody's having a bad day, the cashier at Target or the grocery store is having a bad day, and I actually look into their eyes and tell them have a pleasant day and tell them how much I appreciate that they're doing this, that they're, yes, it's their job. They actually smile, and then they ask the next customer as I'm leaving, how are you? And it seems to cause quite a chain reaction.
Wow.
When you're being polite. At least it is with me.
Kat, thank you so much. Well, Dave, she brings up a lot there. She has experienced economic benefit from being nice, she says. I suspect she'd do it even without that benefit. She rewards others with economic benefit. She'll patronize a business that's nicer, even if it's a bit more expensive. We'll stop there. I mean, is that the kind of thing you see in your real-world research and in your experiments?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the kind of thing that we're thinking about, is those kinds of, like, if you are nice, people are more inclined to reward you, and similarly, you're more inclined to reward people that are nice. And so for both of those reasons, it's both of those reasons together create a system in which it becomes in everyone's self-interest to be nice. And I just want to point out one other thing, which is that it's true that it is typically pays, but as you said, a lot of people, and I think most people, often are nice just because it feels good, not because they're doing some kind of calculation of, oh, look, this is going to be in my, you know, self-interest. But the we've done a lot of work arguing that a lot of why it feels good is because we learn to feel good doing cooperative things because cooperative things are typically rewarded. And so you wind up internalizing that good feeling of like, oh, it's nice, it feels nice to help other people because that's actually a good strategy.
Before I take another caller, Kat also mentioned, in effect, a contagion effect of being nice. She's nice to someone, then she sees them being nice to someone else. Is that something you've seen or tried to figure out in your research?
Definitely. So this is called a like pay it forward kind of effect or contagion, social contagion. We've definitely done a bunch of work on social contagion, and it's something that is a widely documented phenomena. And there's at least a couple of different things going on there. One of them is that if you're used to living in a world where there's a lot of this reciprocity going on, then you come up with a general rule of thumb, which is if people are nice to me, I should be nice. And so even though it's not sort of actually in your interest to be nice to the next person rather than the person who is nice to you because you're not actually reciprocating, it's just kind of this reciprocal circuit gets triggered. And then the other thing is, like I was saying before, where there are these social norms that if you're in an environment where other people are cooperative, then it's good for you to be cooperative, whereas if you're in an environment where other people are selfish, then it's good for you to be selfish. And so when someone is nice to you, that gives you a signal that this is an environment where it's actually good to be cooperative.
Back to our callers with Rod in Madison. Rod, hi.
How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call. You know, maybe it's generational for me, but I just think that the nice portion of it is very hard for me to grasp because, you know, I would emphasize more that people should be respectful, and but they should be fair. I mean, when you're in a work environment, you got to get things done. I feel like nice people focus on, you know, doing what somebody asked them to do, but fair and respectful people force you to go where you might not want to go, but you have to go there in order to get the job done. And I think of my kids who are in their early 20s, nice is almost equated to how you make them feel as opposed to pushing the responsibilities that they're obligated to fulfill. So maybe it's the way I'm interpreting nice, but I look more at the what we have to get done. And I might not be extremely nice about it, but I'll try to be fair and professional and respectful, but I'm not grasping the emphasis of how nice I am about it.
Rod, thanks a lot for the call. So we've focused on the word nice, Dave, and maybe we need to define it, but maybe this is a case of the distinction Rod's making between if I'm bending over backwards to do all the stuff that you should be doing, that's a little too nice. It's not helping anybody as long as I'm being polite, respectful, and holding everybody to a high standard. That still meets our positive definition of a good workplace interaction, right?
Yeah, for sure. So this is a really good point that the word nice is misleading here. In sort of technical terms, what we mean when we talk about cooperation is doing something that is costly for you but beneficial for one or more other people, where the costs aren't necessarily dollars and cents but time or effort or whatever. So and typically it's you incur a cost to provide a benefit to someone else that's bigger than the cost that you are providing. So, for example, if someone's under a really tight deadline and they need your help to finish a project, you put in some time, and that's costly to you because you could have been doing something else at that time. But because they're on a deadline, it's extremely valuable for them to get the help, and so that sort of like increases the size of the pie for everyone. Or to go with a baking analogy, when you think about asking your neighbor to lend you some sugar, because you're out of sugar and you're trying to bake something, that sugar is more valuable to you than it is to your neighbor. And so when they give you that sugar, it sort of makes everyone overall better off. And so there's lots of examples of things that wouldn't count as nice in a traditional sense and are examples of the kind of thing that the caller was saying that would very much fit this definition, where someone is doing something that is costly for themselves but is making the other person even better off.
We're talking to David Rand about his research in the Human Cooperation Lab at Yale, showing that it pays to cooperate, be kind, get along with our coworkers and other people in our lives. We're taking your calls to, in your experience, does it pay to be nice, to get along, to work with our coworkers, help out when we can? Do people treat you better when you are nice, when you're helpful to them? Or do you need to be a jerk every now and then to get ahead in life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation with David Rand. He's with the Human Cooperation Lab at Yale University. He's explaining his research on the behavioral economics of kindness, which shows that being nice, that cooperating can pay off. What do you think about this? Is being nice just a waste of your time? Do you feel taken advantage of when you're helpful at your workplace? Or do you focus on being helpful, maybe helping somebody finish that project at the last minute? Do you feel like you're treated differently, better? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. So, Dave, if somebody wants to change their workplace or other organization, and right now it's a shark tank, everybody's in it for themselves, they're not cooperating, there's no benefit for an individual in being nice, how could someone, maybe a boss, a new boss, change that environment?
It's a really good question, and that's one of the things that we're most interested in and sort of actively studying right now, is sort of the question of how do you change the culture of an organization. And at least one thing that you can do is that you, if you're the boss, you can, or the sort of, you know, the leader of the organization, you can set up certain rules, institutional rules, that reward people for being cooperative. And typically, I would think not reward them in terms of paying them, but giving people recognition, saying, hey, this person went out of the way to do this really nice thing for this other person, and that's great for the organization, and we really sort of respect and admire this, and like, good for that person. These kind of things where you recognize people for doing cooperative actions both makes that person feel good and makes them more inclined to do it, and also communicates to everyone else in the organization that this is a place where people do cooperative things, where people are willing to help each other, and that's something that's valued.
Is this a trend in the country, in the business world, say, that companies are recognizing that they need to build this culture of cooperation?
I think so. I think that there was, in say the 80s, there was this this idea of naked self-interest as, you know, on markets and stuff like that as the core to human behavior, basically, and everyone's only out for themselves, and that means, you know, stomp on top of the other guy and climb to the top of the mountain. And I think that there has been a realization that started in the social sciences and I think is now is permeating out into the greater culture that when you are in this world of repeated interactions and future consequences, it actually turns out that being cooperative and helpful is the thing that winds up maximizing your payoff. And we actually find in some of our experiments that the most selfish people often wind up being the most cooperative when the rules are set up in the right way, such that cooperating really is what earns you money.
Talking to David Rand from Yale University about some of the social science and economics between cooperation and kindness. Back to your calls now. We've got Tom on the line in Waupaca. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and so often people think it would be helpful if I was a jerk to the prosecutor or to the complaining witness, but I found out over 25 years of practice that it works out much better if I'm nice to the prosecutor, nice to the witnesses, nice to the jury, and nice to opposing counsel, just because, as your program has been saying, you know, when if you're going to work at a place for 20 years, there comes payback time, and
right.
You need to build some credibility and some goodwill with the people that you're going to work with over the decades.
And Tom, I got to ask, what about jurors? I mean, do you think that they look more favorably on the case you're making if you present yourself as a nice fella?
Well, absolutely. And I have to say, just 2 weeks ago, I lost a jury trial. I think it was because I was being sort of insulting to the prosecutor. And I think he was so gracious to me. And I think the jury liked the way he treated me better than the way I treated him. So I'm still learning that lesson.
Tom, thank you so much. Well, Dave, if I ever thought of a profession where you want somebody to be an angry pit bull, this is it, the criminal defense attorney. But no, Tom says.
Yeah, totally. That makes complete sense to me.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Tom. So, I mean, in a profession like that, again, how maybe there are other attorneys out there listening or other places where people think, I need to be mean, I need to be a jerk to do my job right. What would it take for them to rethink that and get it more into this cooperative get-along mindset?
Well, I mean, that's a major motivation for my research and also for why I like doing things like, you know, talking on radio shows like this, is that I feel like there is this real misunderstanding amongst a lot of people about thinking of, oh, that's helping other people and being cooperative is just being weak. But I think that when you think about it and when you reflect on these kind of things, you realize, oh, wait, when we have future consequences, when we have long-term relationships, it really, what I do is going to come back around to affect me. And so I think the more this kind of knowledge gets spread, the more people will be inclined to realize, oh, actually, I should be cooperating, and we should all be cooperating with each other, and it'll make us all better off.
Back to our callers. Beth is with us in Duluth. Beth, hi.
Hi there.
Oh, what do you think, Beth?
I think it's definitely this is the right track to go, the kindness track. I was raised to be kind to people without any expectation, any return, any payout, but boy, has it paid off in my job. I take even the grumpies and I just try to make them look as good as possible and help them out whenever I can. And it really comes back to me. When I need help, then people are willing to drop everything and help me because I've helped them. And then it's also put me in a good standing with my bosses because if they want something like right now, I'm able to get on my hands on it right now because other people are willing to drop everything and help me out. So I think it's whether you experience that or not, you can go home at the end of the day feeling good because you treated people respectfully.
Beth, thanks so much for the call. Another case study there, Dave. As we wrap up, I'm going to ask you a huge question with not much time. Are we inherently built, do you think, to be cooperative in this way?
I've done a lot of work showing that that most people have a strong intuitive response to be cooperative, but I don't think it's about evolution and that kind of being built. I think it's about learning, and I think it's that we learn over the course of our lifespans that, like, you know, as kids, we're always sort of rewarded for being nice and punished for not being nice. And you sort of pretty quickly learn that the way to be successful is to be cooperative if you're in a culture and a world where that's what is being rewarded.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for being with us. Very interesting.
Thank you for the invitation. It was very nice to talk to you.
That was David Rand. He's a professor of psychology, economics, and management at Yale University. He's also the director of Yale's Human Cooperation Lab. With us to talk about his research showing that it pays to be nice. You can keep sharing your stories, by the way, and see a link to some related research over at the Central Time Facebook page. Well, maybe I'll start being nice to, you know, Veronica and the producers here and Michelle at the board. I know, it's a tall order. Nobody believes it's going to happen.
The word spinster didn't always have an unflattering meaning attached to it. It began as an honorable reference to unmarried women who spun thread for a living in 15th century Europe.
Our next guest is out to restore the word spinster. In her world, the word means leading a passionately lived, fully intentional life as a single woman.
Kate Bullock joins us now. She's a contributing editor to The Atlantic and the author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Kate, how would you describe what the word spinster means to you and how it evolved over the years for you?
To me, the spinster has always been an image of self-reliance and autonomy and even a kind of glamorous inscrutability. We don't know what the spinster is up to behind the closed doors of her home. And so she's free to be whoever she likes. And I don't know where I got that idea, but that's how I've always thought of her, of the spinster.
Well, your book grew out of a magazine article on being a single woman, and that really struck a nerve for a lot of people. And you found out while you were researching that you were really part of a growing demographic of women who choose not to marry and not to be in a formal partnership. How big a trend is that today?
Well, I would say it's not necessarily that women are choosing not to marry or rejecting marriage outright, although, of course, many women do, but it's more about how women are pushing marriage off and getting married later and have a more ambivalent relationship to the idea of marriage and don't necessarily organize their lives around it the way we have in the past.
So spinster to you is not something that you choose and you sort of brand yourself with it and that's you for the rest of your life. It's sort of the best choice for now.
I mean, that's one way of putting it. I would say that what I'm trying to get at in the book is that there is no one right way of doing things and that our romantic and domestic arrangements are all highly personal, individualized, and have been different at different points in history. People have always been questioning them and rearranging them. So we tend to think that there has been one right way or that marriage has always been the one and only way. And so not only is that not true, but I want people to walk away from the book just being aware of the variety of possibilities, and that one needn't swear themselves to one way of being, that they're, you know, one could be single for 5 years and then get married, or single for 15 years and get married, or be married for 20 years and then become single.
Do we know what's driving the demographic of women choosing to put off marriage?
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, it's without a doubt the gains of the second wave of the women's movement. So all of the battles that were fought then have been, you know, the women of my generation and, you know, a couple of generations before me have been living out those gains. And we are, you know, pursuing careers and educations in higher numbers than ever before. So this has been going on for quite a while, but now the numbers have finally swelled to such a degree that it's a much more visible shift than it was. So this is so it's been taking place, but sort of invisibly. And now that we have more than, you know, half of women are unmarried, it's just undeniable. We can't sideline the single experience the way that we once could.
And you write that early on, women are raised their whole lives, intentionally maybe or not, with two questions at the back of their mind, always sometimes at the front of their mind. Who am I going to marry and when am I going to marry them? What do you think is the consequence of growing up with those two questions always being present somehow?
I think that it over-prioritizes the importance of romantic love and then makes a person feel like a failure if they don't find it at a certain time. I think that a lot of a woman's self-worth can be erroneously invested in whether or not she's found someone. And it also sort of takes the light off of more or equal. I'm not denying the importance of love. I think love is a very important thing in a person's life, but also one's talents and ambitions and, you know, skills and strengths, these are all just as important. And instead, we tend to be, you know, society is telling young girls that marriage is the most important thing, not these other things, even though at the same time in schools we're, you know, trying to empower girls to pursue their own strengths and so forth.
And when your mother died, you, it sounds like, realized that those questions were not exactly how you wanted to frame your life anymore. How did you shift the way you started thinking about yourself and the path that lay ahead?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you're bringing up that part of the book because, you know, I didn't realize that my mother and her death would be part of the book until I started writing it. And I was kind of dismayed because I wanted this to be a book of my 30s. I wanted it to be an adult book. And to realize that I had to start at the age of 23 when she died, because that's really when I started becoming an adult, and that in her death really absolutely shaped the way that I approached my adulthood. And that was with the feeling of, you know, she had been sort of a late bloomer. She had put her own ambitions to be a writer aside in order to raise my brother and me. I don't think she was at all tormented by her choices. She loved being a mother. She loved my father. But I felt and, you know, witnessed her frustration around work when she finally did start pursuing her writing ambitions in her late 30s. And then she, you know, sort of right as she was coming into her own and feeling the full measure of her powers, she got breast cancer and died at 52. And it was, you know, traumatized. I mean, you know, it was a terrible time. It was terrible to lose her. But it also made me feel so deeply how short life is, and that there isn't time to be making compromises, and that I knew that I wanted to try to become a writer, and that that would take a lot of work, and that that's the star I wanted to guide myself by. And yeah, sorry, go on.
And having lost your mother, you were pretty young still at that point, it sounds like you looked for women who could have those meaningful conversations about how to direct your life, and you found them, and you found them in other writers. They weren't present in your life except for through their writing. You call them awakers. Who were they?
Yeah, so they were Maeve Brennan, a mid-century essayist for The New Yorker, Neith Boyce, who was a journalist and novelist at the turn of the last century, who wrote a column for Vogue called The Bachelor Girl in the year 1898 about her decision to never marry. Edith Wharton, who became the famous grande dame and novelist we know her as only after she left her husband in her 40s and she lived alone for the rest of her life. Edna St. Vincent Millay, who in the early 1900s was America's most famous and iconic single woman, before she ended up marrying and having an open marriage. And then Charlotte Perkins Gilman, the feminist writer and activist, also from the turn of the last century.
And what did you learn from exploring these women's lives and their choices?
Well, you know, I'd say, you know, I call them my awakeners, which is a term I borrowed from Edith Wharton, who used it in her memoir to describe the books and people who had guided her intellectual journey. And what these women did for me is I would, you know, I just found them in the course of my own reading. I would happen upon them, or a new biography would come out, and I would start these conversations with them in my head, and then I would start going in deeper. I'd go past the biography and find their letters and diaries or people who knew them, and really start learning about their lives. And they each taught me very different things that were all so highly, you know, personal or idiosyncratic, you know, what I took away from them. But what they all had in common was a very deliberate approach to their own lives, that they questioned their own motivations each step of the way, lived with great intention. And that's what I found ultimately most useful about from between all of them. That's what they were all very different women, but what they all had in common was great intentionality and deliberation, that they didn't take anything for granted or follow convention for the sake of it, but paused and thought about what was best for them, even if that meant reversing course and making a decision and deciding it was the wrong decision. You know, in the case of Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who was born in 1860, she decided as a teenager, I'm never marrying. I want to change the world. I've got lots of things to do. I don't have time to get married. But then in her early 20s, fell in love with a man, and the only way to have sex during that time, in a non-scandalous way, was to be married. And so after 2 years of pushing him off, she finally succumbed to marriage and was in love with him, but was feeling physical desires, and then ended up getting pregnant and falling into America's most famous postpartum depression, which she immortalized in her story, The Yellow Wallpaper. And she decided after that, you know, this just isn't for me. I'm not supposed to be married. And so her husband married her best friend, and she and her husband shared custody of her daughter. You know, this was totally unheard of at this time in the late 1800s. And she was a public figure. People were so angry at her for doing this. She received a lot of censure. But, you know, what she did was spend the next 10 years of her life traveling around the country, calling herself a woman at large, was her self-designation, lecturing on topics about how to change and improve women's lives. So, you know, I see her as very inspiring in that sense, that she knew what she wanted. She made a mistake. She corrected for the mistake.
It's interesting that you went back to these five women of earlier generations for kind of your role models and your guides. Do you think there are contemporary role models and guides? I'm thinking of Carrie Bradshaw, Sex and the City, or Ally McBeal, and they don't seem to have the same substance.
Right. I think that, you know, we're still in a moment that is not offering a lot of examples for how to be a single woman, and that the examples that are on offer are very narrow, urban, professional, kind of dating obsessed. I mean, I like both of those shows as shows, but I don't blame them for not. It's not the fault of the shows that we don't have enough varieties on offer. There just need to be more. So that's why, you know, I was feeling that paucity of options when I was, you know, in my late 20s and early 30s, and looking back, and I knew that I would find guides and role models during the second wave of the women's movement. You know, there was an enormous public critique of marriage and conversation going on then, but I hadn't known about this same conversation going on at the turn of the last century, and so just finding it was very exciting and fresh to me. And the ways in which women were talking about their lives then was very personal and intimate, because it was pre-ideological. Today, the conversation is encumbered with a lot of jargon and specific notes that need to be hit. But they were writing at a time before the conversation had been codified, so their voices felt more intimate to me. And then also, of course, the fact that they all lived a long time ago and were writers means that they, you know, there are records of the ways in which they were thinking about these questions that I think about. So there are plenty of women doing that now, but I don't have access to their diaries and email accounts. So I can't be reading the way that they think about it. And so that it was, you know, because these women lived so long ago and so much had been written about them and that they had left records behind, that I was able to create this internal conversation with them.
We're talking right now to Kate Bullock. She's the author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own.
And we want to hear from you. You can give us some insight into what's going on today. Are you part of this growing demographic of women who choose to be single? What do you like about the single life? Would you choose it all over again? And do you think society is ready to give equal standing to single women? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking now to Kate Bullock. She's the author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own.
And we want to hear from you. Are you one of the growing number of women who choose to stay single? What do you like about the single life? Would you choose it all over again? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our callers now and take a call from Kate in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question for both you and Kate. I'm young, personally, and I'm married, and I am expecting a child in September. And my question was, you know, I kind of always had this idea in my mind about getting married at a young age and then eventually, you know, having kids before 30. And I guess I was kind of wondering how biology kind of played a role in all of this, because that was just my idea, you know, having kids at 26, you know. And starting the family, because I feel like if I was to do it later, like how she was saying, that maybe it would be too late, you know?
Right. Great question, Kate. Thank you for bringing that up. The biological clock, does that play sort of an imperative role in some of this? Because there are options, as you say, and you want women to know the options they have and to explore them, but there are certain things you can't work around, like how long you can have babies.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I happen to be one of the people who never had a strong desire to have children. So that made it easier for me to be more ambivalent about marriage, because I just was ambivalent about starting a family as it was. But, you know, and then what's also interesting right now about this new day and age in which we live is assisted reproductive technologies and how that's changing the landscape as well. And so, you know, once upon a time, a spinster, the classic definition was an unmarried, childless woman past her prime. And now I just wrote an article for Cosmopolitan magazine about the rise of single mothers by choice and women who are choosing to have children on their own. So that's adding a new twist to this whole changing demographic. And I sometimes, in a sort of utopian, idealistic way, I wish that we could totally rechange society so that women were having babies at their biological baby-making prime between the ages of 18 and 25. And so we could all have babies then, and then, you know, have college and careers set up, you know, and then our mothers are retiring just in time to be taking care of the children or something, you know. But it's very complicated working this all out. And we still, you know, America is so behind the rest of the Western world in the ways in which we don't support working mothers. So it does make it really hard for women to be figuring out how to map out their lives.
Thank you so much for that call, Kate. Appreciate that. We have an open line at 800-642-1234. And Kate's question reminds me, I read some of the conversation that was started up because of your book, and there were some married women with children who wrote to say, this is so interesting. I'm very thoughtful about this because I feel as though my life is unfolding in a way that maybe I would have thought differently about if I'd read this book first, and I'm going to think about it and watch what happens. You get a lot of response from women who have chosen marriage and children who are thinking differently about their lives.
I do, yeah. I hear from everybody in all kinds of situations, and it's, you know, I write early in the book, I was reading Milan Kundera, and he had some line about women. I was struck by the idea that women seem to often be running away from their lives once they had created them, and that why couldn't we be figuring it out beforehand, or having that time on our own beforehand? Why were we leaving husbands and children behind in order to find that, like at least in novels or something? But yeah, I do hear from lots of women saying that this is, yeah, they wish they could have thought about things a little bit differently. And that is great for me to hear, because what I'm also loving is hearing from young women in their early 20s saying, oh, thanks, this is showing me the possibilities, the range of ways to think that I hadn't thought of before, and which is exactly what I want. And the other thing I want a reader to do is to be thinking about her own awakeners, that the women I write about in the book are the ones who were most useful to me. But just like life itself is a very individuated process of making what it, you know, it should be, I think that finding your own awakeners is really useful, and that we each have our own.
Now, other responders to your book said things that were more challenging. They said, you know, sure, she's glamorous now, and she's got a book, and she's beautiful. Wait till she's older. Then it's not going to be such a selling prospect for people to think about. What do you think about that kind of critique?
I find that frustrating and limiting, because it's complicated critique, because, you know, there I am on the cover of this book, you know, a hair stylist and makeup stylist, you know, I've been totally dolled up and look a lot more glamorous than I actually am in my everyday life, right? But also, I'm not choosing, this isn't about rejecting marriage or rejecting love. It's about finding how to balance love and autonomy is what the central conflict of my own adult life has been. So that critique, I think, comes from people who haven't actually read the book.
Well, Kate, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kate Bullock is a contributing editor to The Atlantic, and she's the author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. And we'd love to hear what you have to say about this, about your own life experiences, your own life choices, whether you're a man or a woman. Have you, do you think, fully explored the possibilities and times in your life when you were partnered and unpartnered? And what did you find to be sort of the gifts of both of those times of life? Call us at 800-642-1234, or at this point, go to our Facebook page. You can leave your comments there.